For the series A Book, A Thousand Stories, this is a review of John Suchet's The Last Waltz. Each episode is enriched by beautiful music selected by Gerald Fennec. The script is mine, Patricia Salomone. We have reached the sixth program in this series, and we now begin to witness the rise of the younger Johann Strauss and the gradual decline of his father, who resolutely refused to acknowledge his son's musical genius. In August 1844, Johann the Younger requested permission to hold musical entertainments at Don Meyer's Casino, a suburban tavern. The permission was granted, and the first concert was due to be held in October. There were now two Johann Strauss orchestras, but the elder of the two Strauss conductors simply did not believe that his son would get anywhere. He held his concerts in the most prestigious halls of Vienna. His son had secured an engagement in this suburban casino, out beyond the Bastille. He advised the owners of music halls that if they staged his son's concerts, he, the famous Johann Strauss, would never again play at their concert halls. He is said to have organized a claque to disrupt the younger man's concert. He went so far as to program a concert with his own orchestra on the same night as his son's debut, so as to attract the public away. This, however, did not materialize, for, no matter how hard Strauss the Older tried with his sabotage, the young Strauss's debut was awaited with much anticipation. The journal The Wanderer announced that getting a seat for Johann's debut was as difficult as getting a seat at the House of Lords in the British Parliament. It must be said that the young man had much going for him. It was known that, notwithstanding his young age, he was 19, he was well prepared. With his mother's complicity, his father completely unaware, he had taken lessons from his father's senior violinist, Franz Amon, at the Vienna Court Opera. Amongst his teachers in harmony and counterpoint was the Kapellmeister of St. Stephen's Cathedral, who was choirmaster and composer of around 35 operas, one of Vienna's most respected musicians, Josef Dreschler. The music cognoscenti were curious to find out how much of his famous father's genius the young man had inherited. Many, in truth, were inclined to show solidarity with him for the brash and harsh way in which his father tried to put obstacles in his path. There was also universal sympathy for Anna Streim, Strauss's senior's long-suffering wife, humiliated by her husband's unconventional domestic life, his disregard for her and their legitimate children, and the long liaison he had with Emily Trumpusch, whom he kept in the Kumpfgasse, and with whom he had fathered no less than 8 children. So, on a lovely autumn evening, crowds streamed out of the city centre through the gates of the Basté, across the Glacé, and to the suburb of Heitzing to Dommeyer's. Johann's orchestra consisted of a band of 15 poorly rehearsed musicians, a far cry from his father's famous orchestra. His programme contained well-known pieces by Meyerbeer, Fonsuppert, and Auber. But what the audience awaited most were his own compositions. From this first concert they would judge whether this youth was the worthy son of so famous a father. Silence fell in the crowded hall as Johann Jr. stepped to the stage. Suddenly there was a gasp from the audience. The handsome, elegant young man, same jet-black hair as his father's, same swagger of self-confidence, same mesmerizing stage presence. Then, John Suchet writes, Johann raised his violin and settled it comfortably under his chin. The whole top part of his body bent into the opening triplet of chords, played fortissimo. The notes of the Kunstfaber flowed into the air, dedicated to his most staunch supporter, the one who had believed in him against all odds, in opposition to her husband, his mother, Anna. We'll be right back. Applause followed applause, and Johann was to repeat the Gunstverber 4 times until, with a calculated gesture, he introduced the opening bars of his father's most popular work, Lorelei, the Rheinklange. It was the young man's tribute to his famous father. The audience appreciated the gesture, and the evening was a triumph. On the morrow, the music critics were unanimous in their praise. A well-known critic wrote, "Talent is the monopoly of no single individual." This young man is fully as melodious, as piquant, as effective in his instrumentation as his father, and he is no slavish imitator of his father's methods. Another journalist stated, "Of Strauss' son, one can say, he is waltz incarnate." Our author writes, "Franz Weist, music critic of Der Wanderer, remembering this was the year following the death of Josef Lanner, ended his critique with the prophetic words, 'Good night, Lanner, good evening, Strauss father, and good morning, Strauss son.'" At this stage of his book, John Suchet gives us an interesting insight into the political situation on the European continent towards the middle of the 19th century. As winds of change ranged through Europe, starting from the barricades in Paris, there was discontent from bottom up. The working classes resented the wealth and influence of the aristocracy, and the aristocracy resented the absolute power of the monarchy. Suchet writes, "Technological advances were transforming workers' lives, and in several European countries, an increasingly liberal press was campaigning for better conditions and higher wages."
Known as the springtime of people, the 1848 revolutions were marked by a popular upheaval. The causes behind the bursting of the dike were many, as were the responses in the different contexts where revolts unfolded. The revolutions failed in all places, except in France, and yet still, the historical import of these outbursts was to have a long-term ripple effect, as a huge number of people rose up to their acclaimed rights and fought for what they aspired. There have been plenty of greater revolutions in the history of the modern world, noted historian Eric Hobsbawm, and certainly plenty of more successful ones. He adds, however, there has been none which spread more rapidly and widely, running like a bushfire across frontiers, countries, and even oceans, as the 1848 revolts. A reassessment of this phrase in light of the aptly dubbed Arab Spring, also characterized by the quick and sweeping domino effect it had on the North African continent since 2010, would be most fitting. But Hobsbawm's evaluation still runs strong and points to the obvious question as to what caused the 1848 revolts in Italy, France, the Austrian Empire, Switzerland, Germany, and roughly the rest of the continent barring Britain and Russia. Historians disagree on what was the ultimate straw, a bunch of them, to break the camel's back. But these revolts had found inspiration from the French Revolution is a point of little to no doubt. Although historians stress some factors more than others, and debate on the way to these carried as long-term or short-term causes, it is safe to conclude that what happened in 1848 was the outcome of a conjunction of crises, namely agrarian, industrial, economic, and political. With an increasing strain on resources, as the population of Europe soared from 187 million in 1800 to 250 million in 1840, an agrarian crisis resulted. Poor and failed harvests triggered famines, instigating public disorder in several places, most of all Ireland, Belgium, Holland, and Germany. Prices of bread and rice skyrocketed, while deficient railway systems, where available, made supply more problematic. It is ironic how industrialization in this instance was a double-edged sword. While insufficient industrialization in some parts worsened the agrarian crisis, its development in others left an indelible sinister effect on the cottage industry and skilled workers who were being displaced by machines. It brought about bad urban conditions and caused inadequate sanitation, diseases, and widespread misery. Hence, towns became breeding grounds for commotion and centers of discontent, with a mass of uneducated and disenchanted, because impoverished, workers, featuring rising criminality, awful working conditions, strikes, and riots. The bourgeoisie too suffered as a decline in consumer power sapped at their profits, leading to a credit squeeze and ultimately bankruptcy. Even if for different reasons, the middle and working class alike lost their confidence in the government and were keen on bringing about change. However, the economic factors on their own would not explain some of the revolutionary outbreaks where the forces of liberalism and nationalism were more momentous. Through the Congress system, it had been hoped that these forces be suppressed. However, different groups across Europe kept the feelings alive. Either because of the need for political representation and the demand for the rule of law and civil liberties, or because of the power of a shared common culture, language, history, and the concept of the nation-state, action was taken, especially by the middle class, to bring about the desired change.
Again, it all started in Paris, but the revolt spread like wildfire. It was to be short-lived, but to have enormous repercussions all over the Western world. In Austria, after 30 years of repression under the iron rule of Clemens von Metternich, the working classes demanded to have a voice. On 13th of March, 1848, a crowd of students, workers, and malcontents forced their way into the courtyard of the Lower Austrian Landhaus. The military shot into the crowd, killing five demonstrators. This sparked off a series of events that were to transform Vienna, indeed Austria, forever. Beyond the frontiers of Austria, there was discontent in the lands occupied by the Austrian Empire, in northern Italy, in Hungary. The young Strauss brothers, Johann and Josef, sympathized with the revolutionaries. Strauss' father was all for the old guard. The victory of the Austrians against the Italians in Custoza in 1848 exacerbated the divide between the generations. The establishment in Vienna celebrated the victory with a grand festival in honor of the 82-year-old commander-in-chief of the Austrian army, Field Marshal Johann Josef Wenzel Count Radetzky von Raditz. Strauss' father composed his immortal catchy tune in honor of the hero, the Radetzky March, while Johann Strauss the Younger, like most young men his age, wanted change, even leading his orchestra onto the barricades. He composed a number of revolutionary marches and even found himself arrested for playing La Marseillaise in public. Eventually, Chancellor Metternich lost the support of the Habsburg monarchy and was made the scapegoat of the situation. Together with his wife, he escaped to settle to a nostalgic life in England. The old feeble emperor abdicated in favor of his young, handsome nephew, Franz Josef, and a new era was about to begin for Austria. The lives of the new emperor and of the new king of the waltz would intersect. Johann Strauss the Younger's music would be the leitmotif of Franz Josef's long life. The new emperor would reign for 68 years, right through to the First World War. He would see more pain and tragedy than any normal human being would be expected to bear. But we shall see about this in later stages of the story. Our author writes, as the midpoint of the turbulent 19th century approached, a truly new era in Vienna was dawning. The Viennese knew it, and so did their emperor. Young Johann Strauss and his brothers were in no doubt. The same could not entirely be said of their father. A deep depression took hold of Johann Strauss' father. His music was being rejected. He was being rejected because of his ties to the old regime. Was he not, after all, the composer of the Radetzky March? He took his orchestra out of Vienna to Prague, but there too they were booed and he had to bend over and eliminate the Radetzky March from the program. To some degree or other, in Augsburg, Stuttgart, Heidelberg, Cologne, Bonn, the orchestra was met with some hostility. He decided, therefore, to cross to England. There, once more, it was a triumph. But the relentless schedule, coupled with the English climate, told on his health. Now a divorced man, Johann Strauss Sr. returned to his home in the Kumpfgasse. But there, he contracted scarlet fever from his illegitimate daughter Clementina, dying of it on the 25th September, 1849. Members of the Strauss Orchestra bore his coffin to St. Stephen's Cathedral, and then to Döbling Cemetery, where he was buried alongside his friend and sometime foe, Josef Lanner. 100,000 Viennese lined the funeral route. So went to the grave the great Johann Strauss at the young age of 45. In his honor, to the notes of his Radetzky March, I thank my friends and collaborators Gerald Fennec and Simona Zopardi, as well as the technicians of Campus FM, and I bid my listeners goodbye until the next episode.